Eggert will be discoursing on the subject of the process of intervention. Well qualified to do so. Graduated here in 50, entered parish ministry in Shawnee, Oklahoma, a city of around 25,000 east of Oklahoma City. After having served in the parish there, he began the kind of work which became his major role in life. He was chaplain for the Lutheran Missionary Association in Minneapolis, from there to the Robert Koch Hospital in St. Louis, where he first had the opportunity to begin working specifically in the matter of chemical dependency. During his time there, for 9 years, he also supervised from 9 to 12 field education students from Concordia Seminary each semester, as was the academic plan at that time. From there to Lincoln, Nebraska, as director of the Lutheran Council on Alcoholism, and finally to DePaul Rehabilitation Hospital in Milwaukee, where he served from 69 to 87 as the first director of pastoral care and set up the department there. He comes to us with the goodwill and assistance of the Task Force on Alcohol and Drug Abuse of our Synod, on which he serves with distinction, has to offer to us something which should help each and every one of us in his service under God to the good of men and the glory of the Redeemer. Chaplain Eggert.
Thank you. I need to ask you gentlemen here this morning, they're going to help me with a time lag I'm having a problem with. You know, we talk about having a jet lag. I seem to have a jet advancement because everybody knows that in the middle of January, the temperature is supposed to be below the freezing line and the color of the earth is supposed to be white. And I felt a little better last night. I saw the news report that back home we had 2 inches of snow yesterday. So I'll feel better getting back home. I look like it's January instead. In some place, I've missed part of January, February, and March. It seems more like April down here, doesn't it? But I need to make two quick corrections. Number one, and I'm happy to hear that Professor Hopman already said that I'm not presently at Shawnee, Oklahoma, as several publications have indicated. That was my first place of assignment. And I'm not going to be talking primarily about adolescent chemical dependence. I did that yesterday in Chuck Knipple's class. But I want to lead you through a process of intervention this morning. Now, there's several givens we need to begin with. When I talk about chemical dependence, we have to begin to recognize that alcoholism today is the fourth major cause of death in America, that it is the primary health problem in the world. It is the most expensive illness in America today. When we begin to see that heart disease and cancer deaths are on the decline, deaths by alcoholism are on the increase. That's a given. I think we need to recognize that. And you, as future clergy in the church, better become aware of it, that you're one of your primary issues you're going to be dealing with, and parish activities and counseling are going to be related to chemical dependence. When you think, for example, that the majority of automobile accidents are due to alcohol imbibing, that divorce rates, incest, child abuse, child neglect, divorce, all of these are directly related in one way or another to chemical dependence, up to 80%. People incarcerated in institutions are there 80% because of alcohol-related incidents or offenses. Then you begin to get an idea of how significant the problem of chemical dependence in America is today. So 80% of the problems coming to you as a parish pastor are going to be related to chemical dependence. Now, that's a given. That's why I get excited about talking to future clergy of our church about chemical dependence. How do you deal with this problem in your parish? That's one of the givens we need to begin with. Another given. And I heard it several times from some of you students yesterday, and I hope I can blow this myth. If I do nothing else, I'll have accomplished that much. For many, many years, we were saying loud and clear, you saw it in print, you can't help the alcoholic until he wants help. Gentlemen, that's a bunch of baloney. put it in big red letters in your mind, that is not true. It was one of the most destructive philosophies that ever came along. We saw a lot of good people dying on Skid Row, losing all motivational factors, losing their families, their health, their jobs, because someone came up with a concept that you can't help the alcoholic until he wants help. Today we say, let's help him to want help. AA used the concept for many years, the alcoholic needs to reach bottom. When I first got going in this business, that was synonymous with Skid Row. Let's raise the bottom, and let's help them to want help at an earlier age. That's a given. We can help the alcoholic at any stage in his decline, or regardless of what phase in of his alcoholism is, there is help available to him. I hope I can help you this morning to see how you go about that. Another given. An alcoholic cannot achieve sobriety on his own. A chemical dependent does not achieve sobriety on his own. There's a need for a secondary support system. I hope I can help you to understand what some of those systems are for you this morning. Another given, the pain must exceed the pleasure. If there's no one who is helping the chemical dependent to experience pain, why should he quit? Yeah, some of you discovered very quickly, if there's anything I could become addicted to very quickly, it would be ice cream. I could eat ice cream every day and twice on Sunday. I could eat, and I love cherry pie a la mode. I can't think of anything better. And as long as nobody complains about it, as long as my wife doesn't remind me, hey, don't you think you're getting a little heavy? I can continue to eat cherry pie a la mode. Why should I quit? But if I begin to see that somehow it's affecting my waistline, I'll better quit. Then I need to do something about it. And as long as nobody suggests to the chemical dependent, hey, you're creating problems, your behavior is causing pain for me, and it's going to create pain for you, why should he quit? And so we say the pain must exceed the pleasure. Okay, let's keep just some of those givens in mind as I lead you through what I refer to as a process of intervention. The typical situation. Mrs. Schmaltz comes to you, we'll call her Mary, comes to you as her pastor, and she says, Pastor Bearhorse, won't you come and see Joe? You know, he drinks every day. I can't get him to seem to quit. He's becoming antagonistic. He's becoming very brutal with the children. He doesn't go to work every day. Won't you please come to talk to Joe? Well, you know, we get into this business because we're such humanitarians and we want to please everybody. And Pastor says, why, certainly I'll come talk to Joe. Well, 9 times out of 10, it's a waste of your time. Because Joe can go one of two ways. Joe can say, well, Pastor, you're right. Yes, I do drink too much, and I can remember baptism. I guess I drank too much. And I suppose Mary told you about New Year's Eve. Yeah, I really got kind of bombed New Year's Eve, and I'm really sorry about that, and I apologize to her. But, Pastor, believe me, it won't happen again. What does he do? He has agreed he drinks too much, and he's made the commitment not to do it again. What does he do? You're shot down, see? Mary hasn't been helped. Joe hasn't been helped. The situation hasn't changed any. You have a verbal commitment, which is worthless. Or he can deny it. You say, Pastor, have you ever seen me drunk? You know I've been in church every week. I never miss a voters meeting. You know, the audacity that you kind of would come over and accuse me of being an alcoholic. And so the pastor backs off. He's never seen Joe drunk. He's at a church all the time. So how does he know? See? So the thing we need to begin to recognize is that we don't attack the problem with Joe, but we get at Mary. Well, Mary doesn't have a problem. But she's what we have learned to know today as the codependent. Alcoholism is a family illness, and chemical dependence or alcoholism destroys relationships. The first relationship that's going to be affected is the relationship between husband and wife and then the children, and from there on it branches on out. You know, we sometimes say, for every alcoholic, there are 5 other people affected directly and 5 more indirectly affected. So you see, the multiplication goes out pretty fast. So we begin to talk with Mary, and we help Mary to understand what chemical dependence is and what alcoholism is, and what the symptoms really are, in order to help her to discontinue all the home remedies. You see, her denying, her lying, her minimizing, her rationalizing is going to become just as effective as is Joe's. Suppose one of your wives has a drinking problem. How many of you would go come and tell the prof or the dean, hey, my wife's got an alcohol problem? You say, oh, my goodness, no. You know, nobody should know about this. After I'm a seminarian, and my wife is, I'm sure not going to admit that I'm married. Can I be so stupid as to marry an alcoholic? My goodness, no. And so we keep it very quiet while the disease continues to progress. And alcoholism is a progressive illness. You can mark it on the calendar as how this thing is going to progress over a period of time. So when Mary called me and I said, no, Mary, you come to see me. Why should I come to see you? I asked you to come see Joe. Well, that's all right, but I need to get more information from you. So he said, okay, Mary's willing to come and give me all the information she can to help me to understand how bad Joe's drinking is. I said, Mary, sit down and tell me all about it. When did you first notice this? What are the symptoms? Are you sure that this is really a drinking problem? Because I want to be sure in Mary's mind that this is truly alcoholism. The primary problem is alcoholism. Not some secondary problems, but it's alcoholism. And I go through the chart, and she says, yeah, it applies here and here and here. Some of you may have seen this Jelinek chart, or you can see the phase of alcoholism. Yeah, he's already this phase, he's this phase, wherever. She has to be absolutely sure that the primary problem is alcoholism, and all the symptoms apply to Joe. Okay. We've relieved any possibility of anything else. It's alcoholism. Now I need to help Mary to understand that it's not going to do me any good to talk to Joe, as I explain to you later, and why not. And I say, Mary, you need to get involved in Al-Anon. And again, she says, no, Pastor, you seem to misunderstand this. I'm concerned about Joe's problem, and you're asking me to go to a meeting. Well, I said, yeah, Joe's not going to go to an AA meeting at this point in time. He's still convinced he doesn't have a problem. But you know there's a problem, so you need to go get more information and education so you understand yourself in relationship to Joe. So you don't continue to be the enabler for Joe. How could I be his enabler? Well, you sit down and you talk to Mary and you discover that last Monday morning after a big drinking weekend, what does Mary do? Because Joe can't get his head off the pillow. He's got Monday morning pneumonia. She calls Charlie down to the plant and says, Charlie, I'm sorry, Joe can't get in this morning. He's got pneumonia. Well, gee, that's too bad. I hope he gets me. Oh, he'll be all okay by tomorrow, I'm sure. Well, sure, he's worn the drunk off by that time. Mary shouldn't do that. See, Mary has to begin to understand that she needs to help Joe face full and completely the total responsibility of his behavior. You know, Mary didn't get drunk over the weekend. Why should she call Charlie and say, Joe can't go? It's Joe's responsibility, isn't it? And Mary has to be helped to understand that she has to pull away or withdraw every possible support there possibly can be because of Joe's excessive use of alcohol. So when Joe can't get his head off the pillow, he tells Mary, go get me a drink. Mary says, oh, no, no way. Get it yourself. And the children don't go get him a drink or whatever. But she needs to quit all the enabling and force Joe to experience the full responsibility of his behavior. Mary's not going to be able to do this alone. Not very easily. So she has the support of the Al-Anon people. And now we begin to help Mary to understand that it's going to take more than just Mary's seeing that Joe has a problem. You know, for example, let's say you have pneumonia. And some of the typical symptoms of pneumonia are an elevated temp, fluid in the lungs, pain in the chest, coughing, etc. And let's say you've got four of the five symptoms of pneumonia. Well, you would still not doubt too much that you got pneumonia, right? So somebody has to prepare a symptom list for Joe. If only the wife does it, well, you know what's going to happen. She's going to tell me, or the Joe is going to tell me, well, hey, Pastor, you understand Mary. You know, she's about 40 years of age. I learned a new word when I got to Wisconsin. Women up there go through their changes. You know what that is? I'd heard of women going through menopause, but I'd never heard of women going through changes. Well, that's a favorite word in Wisconsin. Women go through changes up there, and they all become a little dingy when they're in their changes. If you don't believe it, ask an alcoholic man. All their wives are a little dingy. They're in their changes. Or she's gone through some difficulties. She's experienced the empty nest syndrome. Oh, 140 different reasons Joe can think of why Mary's little nuts about her evaluation of his drinking. So it takes more than just Mary to confront him. takes more than Mary and myself, because I don't know anything about his drinking. I've never seen it. You know, I've only got what Mary tells me. So we get what sociologists today refer to as the significant others. Who else in that family galaxy knows something about Joe's drinking? Well, they got four children, and they all know about it. His parents and Mary's parents both live. They still all know about it. The neighbor knows about it because he sees Joe all summer walking around with a wine bottle while he's mowing the lawn. He has a pretty good indication. He's had one or two DWIs, so there's a police officer someplace knows it. The shop foreman knows it because he's had pneumonia about 14 times all through the summer, and he just buried his fifth grandmother. And so he got all kinds of people who know something about Joe's drinking problem. So we say to Mary, listen, we need to get all these significant others together for a training session. How many of these people do you think would be willing to come together, Mary, to help us in our confrontation of Joe? Well, I know the children would. I know my parents would. I'm not sure his parents. I'm sure his mother would. Because, you know, one of the people who is the most difficult to deal with is the mother of the alcoholic son. Or if there's anyone who will tenaciously protect a child, it's the mother of her alcoholic son. So we may let mother out, see. But the neighbor would, maybe the shop foreman knows, maybe the doctor would, maybe there's a police officer, whomever, but all the people that you can think of. Okay, Mary, how many of these people would be willing to come together and help us in a confrontation of Joe? Well, let's say we get the children and her parents and the shop foreman, whomever, and they're all going to come together. Well, how can I tell Joe we're all going to be going? He'd be wondering, where am I and the kids going? Well, tell him you're going, I'll use DePaul Hospital because that's where I work. Tell him you're going to DePaul Hospital for a family night on alcoholism. You want to learn something about it. He may object, but go anyway. Okay. So they all come together, and I generally begin with showing them a film, I'll Quit Tomorrow, which demonstrates very graphically the process of intervention. Generally, after the first showing of I'll Quit Tomorrow, Mary says, no, I can't do it. It's very emotional. And it shows very graphically how the boss and the wife and the daughter confronted Steve, in this case, as the picture shows, how they confronted him and gave him an ultimatum. You know, it's either or, shape up or ship out. Either you drink or you don't have a job. Either you quit drinking or you don't have a family. And the first time around, Mary said, well, I don't know if I can go that far or not. And so I back off again. I try to help her to understand, well, you know, you come to me and you tell me all the problems you got with Joe. I can guarantee you if you do nothing, it's only going to get worse. And in a matter of time, you'll have a funeral bill instead of a hospital bill. Which do you want? Well, okay, she sits down, we go through it again, and after about three or four sessions with them and helping them to write up what I call the symptom list, let me explain that a little bit for you. Each member of these significant others writes up in a rather detailed form, chapter and verse, anything they can recall that happened in their relationship with Joe which affected them negatively as a result of his drinking. Can't be anything generalization. It has to be something specific. They can't, for example, say, well, I remember on my birthday. Which birthday? It was my 16th birthday. I remember at the football game. Which one was it? It was a game between Martin Luther and Milwaukee Lutheran High in 1986. You have to be that specific. But you begin. Don't do it in a way in which you can bring Joe's defensiveness out. You're not doing it judgmentally. You do it with a great deal of love because, you see, the difference between enabling and tough love is that in tough love you allow him to hurt. And that's what we need to do. We need to allow Joe to hurt. And when we come in with a symptom list, it's going to hurt because every one of them reads the list. And it goes something like this. Let's say, for example, Mary's reading her list. And she begins with recounting to Joe how wonderful their marriage had been. How much fun they had in their courting years and how they were looking forward to marriage and the family. And his job, et cetera, et cetera. And then because of your drinking, Joel, a lot of our plans have not been able to be accomplished. We couldn't go on vacation. We had planned this trip. We had planned on building a swimming pool. We had planned whatever it might be. We can't even have, we don't even have money to send Junior to college because you're drinking it all up. And Joe, it's not that I don't love you, but I can't live with you when you're drinking like this because you're not the Joe that I loved as a husband. I still love you and I'm concerned about you, but you need to do something about your drinking. There's a positive, there's a demonstration of what his behavior is doing to her, but there's also a concern on her part to help him to get into treatment. See? It's not like she's throwing him out. The children do the same thing. The neighbor does the same thing. The parents do the same thing. The shop foreman does the same thing. The police officer does the same thing. And they all write up their symptom list, very detailed and complete. Each one of them outlining how Joe's drinking has affected their interpersonal relationship in a negative manner. Now, I have to be sure that everybody is 100% sold on this philosophy. Because, you see, if you have one weak link, if at the time of the intervention one of them says, gee, no, I just can't do it. Maybe, well, let's say one of the children backs out, or maybe mother backs out. Hey, anytime the alcoholic discovers one weak link, he's going to pounce right in there and he's going to use that individual as his cohort. And so you see there, you don't all agree. Mary doesn't think that you guys are all telling the truth. So we have to be sure that everyone has agreed that we're going to do this because we love Joe enough to let him hurt enough that we're going to ultimately give him the ultimatum. Drink or not to drink. Drink or get into treatment. Because the goal of intervention is treatment. See? Now, while this is going on, whoever is facilitating the intervention also has some responsibilities. Now, let's say I'm facilitating the intervention. There are several things I have to do. I have to be sure that Joe has the kind of insurance that is going to pay for his coverage when he comes into treatment. Because if I've gone through the intervention with Joe and Joe finally says, okay, I'll go. What kind of insurance do you have? But it doesn't cover chemical dependence. Oh, now I'm shot down. Well, what I'll do? I've done all this work and I can't even get him into treatment. So I've got to be sure. And I've gotten Mary's insurance card and I've checked with the insurance at the hospital. Yes, his insurance covers 30 days. Inpatient, another $500, outpatient, whatever the case might be. I have to be sure also that there's a bed available. That on the day of the intervention, there will be a bed available. So I get in touch with the admitting department at the hospital, and I say, Barb, I'm doing an intervention on Saturday the 19th. I need a bed sometime that day. I don't tell them I'm coming in the morning or in the afternoon. Sometime on the 19th, I need a bed. Do I have the assurance that there will be a bed available? Okay, there will be a bed. Swell. Now we need to role play this thing. They've all written up their symptom list. I've had an opportunity to take a look at it. And we're going to sit down and role play this thing. And I'm going to play the part of Joe. And I'm going to try to shoot down every argument they bring, every accusation in the sense they bring against me. Because I am not about to agree that I have a drinking problem or that I'm going into treatment. My God, no. So they begin to read this list. But before that, we've also decided who's going to read the list in what order. Well, we may begin with the neighbor. We may begin with one of the children. Or we may have all four of the children read theirs first. Then the shop foreman, because he's agreed that, you know, he's carried Joe as far as he can. It's not either treatment or you don't have a job anymore. And the last one to read the list is always the wife. The one most nearly related to the person with a drinking problem. And this way we role-play this thing, and they read it in that sequence. And after the role-playing, we give everyone an opportunity again. Now, do you have any questions? You know exactly what you're going to do. I want to remind you, don't get on the defensive. Don't sound accusatory or judgmental. You're just spelling it out as an honest feeling that you have about the breakdown in the relationship as a result of Dad's drinking. Okay, we got that all lined up. Everybody's agreed. Now we have to set up the logistics, don't we? When and where are we going to do the intervention? Well, there's different philosophies about that. Some people feel you have to do the intervention in the hospital. I find it's more effective to do it in their home. And I think almost all the interventions I've done have done in their home. So, okay, when is Joe most apt to be most sober? Saturday morning, early, before he starts mowing the lawn or whatever. Okay, how are we going to set this up? The mother lives there, two of the children live there, but the other two children don't live there anymore. The boss isn't there, the police officer isn't there. Obviously, I'm not there. I may not have even met, I probably haven't even met Joe by this time. I've never seen him. Okay, we're agreed. We're going to meet on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. The two children are there. The other two children, the police officer, the shop foreman, and myself, we meet at JoJo's on the corner of 108th and Janesville Road. Okay. We're going to meet there in the parking lot, and we're going to go over en masse. And at 9 o'clock, I'm going to push the doorbell, and either Joe or his wife are going to be coming to the door, and Joe's just getting done finishing his breakfast, and he said, what's going on? And Mary introduces me to Joe. It's the first time we've met. He knows the shop foreman. He's not sure of the police officer. You look a little familiar. And I say, Joe, and we've also agreed where we're going to do this. We're going to do this in the living room. And I've got a pretty good idea of the geographic layout of the living room. And we know where the exit doors are. And either I'm placed on the mail at the primary exit door or the oldest son is, whomever, so Joe can't get up and walk out because we're going to stop him. So, Joe, why don't you come, let's go sit in the living room, and we'd like to talk with you a while. Well, what's this all about? Well, I'll tell you in just a minute. Come on in. Okay, we'll all sit down. We know exactly where everybody's going to sit. It's all been prearranged. And I facilitate this thing, and I say, Joe, as you look around here, you know all these people pretty well, don't you? Maybe not the police officer. But you know these people, and these people are concerned about you. They all love you very much. They're very concerned about your health and your well-being. They've been in to see me a number of times, and according to their description, they feel very strongly that you have a drinking problem. And we're here to help you to understand that there is treatment available for you. Would you please sit down and listen to our program this morning? Well, okay, yeah, sure. He sits down. And I said, Joe, what we're going to do is... And I go through this little deal about people understanding symptoms of pneumonia, and you got four, you wouldn't doubt there's pneumonia. And these people have what I'm going to refer to as a symptom list. And each one of these is going to read what they feel are indicators of the fact that you have a drinking problem. I would like, Joe, very much if you would just sit here and listen to these, not interrupt if at all possible, but you will be given an opportunity for rebuttal after they have all read their symptom list. Would you? And you don't have to do anything. Just listen to us in the meantime. Would you be willing to do that this morning, Joe? Well, okay. With some degree of hesitation, he finally says, okay, I'll sit down. And everybody knows who's going to read the first list, so they begin. And about halfway through this, he says, oh, wait a minute. Now, you haven't got that quite right. You know, this happened. Joe, just wait a minute. You'll be given an opportunity to just hear your son out for a minute and... hear what he's all got to say, and you will be given an opportunity in due time to react and respond and offer rebuttal. But would you just please just listen for a minute? Okay, he settled back down again. And this way the whole thing goes through, and this thing becomes more and more emotional. You could cut the tension in there. The children are all crying. The shop foreman is sitting over there sucking one cigarette after another. He's nervous as a cat on a hot tin roof. And the police officer doesn't quite know what he should be doing. He's fiddling with his thumbs. And I'm trying to look cool as a cucumber and keep Joe relaxed over here, see? Well, by the time they've all read their list with a lot of crying, and we've always got a box or two of Kleenex around, they've gone through this thing, I said, Joe, you wanted to say a few things a while ago. This is your opportunity. Well, it will go one of two ways. Either he's just totally shot down, or he's like the bull in the china closet, ready to fight the whole gang single-handed. And he wants to just charge out here and say, oh, wait a minute, Joe. We can't let you go yet. And the other children are there. No, Pop, sit down. See, and his wife says, honey, will you just sit down and listen? You know, and I try to help him understand why this is important and there's treatment available and why it's so difficult for him to understand that he does have a problem. It's the nature of the illness. It destroys rational thinking and memory, etc. I can understand that you believe that these things have all been exaggerated, and I can try to help him to understand that. And I said, well, Joe, having listened to all this, what are you willing to do about it? And again, they go one of two ways. Those of you who may have seen the film, I'll Quit Tomorrow, the first thing Steve says, well, I'll quit. Over and out. I'll quit. I'll never drink again. How many times do you suppose you've told your wife that in the last 5 years? Last 10 years? And Mary pops them, she says, well, every Monday morning. Every Friday evening when he comes home and he starts drinking, I said, please don't do it, Joe. And he says, okay, I'll just have one for this evening. I won't drink any more tomorrow. And tomorrow and Sunday are just gone. I said, you see, Joe, I believe you really mean that you're not going to do it again, but you see, you haven't been able to keep your own promise. Much as you want to, you just can't do it anymore. And so, Joe, we really have to have something more than just your promise that I'm not going to do it anymore. Well, what do you want me to do? I'll join AA. I know Pete down the block. I know he goes to AA. I don't know what's all, but I guess it's for drunks. I'll go with him, okay? Depending on how severe this problem has been, and most times by the time the wife comes to see you and hear all these other people are involved, this thing has progressed anywhere from 5 to 15 years. And I'm a real skeptic as to how effective AA is with someone who has been into the drinking that long. And so in my programming and my education with the family and helping them to set up alternatives, depending on how severe the problem has been described, I suggest to him, let's not settle for AA. Let's go for treatment for these reasons. So when Joe says, well, okay, I'll go with Ralph down the meeting. I don't know what it's all about. I guess it's for drunks. I'll go there. I said, no, Joe, you know, if your wife had cancer and the doctor says it's already metastasized into three other major organs, would you settle for an aspirin treatment? Well, of course not. I said, okay, that's what you're asking us to do for you. Your alcoholism has progressed up to here, and I show him the chart. I said, from what we've heard here this morning, you are already up here. You know, you can't treat this with a Band-Aid. It's not a quick fix thing. You need to come into treatment for how long? Well, I said, I don't know. Nobody can tell you. You know, when you go to the doctor and he says you got to come in for the hospital, he'd probably say 2-3 days or whatever it might take. And that's the way we kind of put it off. Well, generally it's a 30-day treatment program, but we don't know. You may be able to go through this thing. It may take you a little longer. We don't know, Joe. But you need to come into treatment. Initially, he may absolutely refuse. No way. I'll quit drinking. I'll promise you I'll quit drinking. Period. Let's go on to do something else. But by this time, the family's been in treatment themselves and an education process, so they know that they can't accept that kind of a commitment from Joe because they know it's not going to work. So they have already determined in their own mind what the alternative is going to be. The alternative, Joe, is treatment. Well, what if Joe says, I'm not going to do it? Well, you have to have this plan worked out, too. Let's say Joe says, well, if that's the way you're going to be about it, I'll just pack up my ditty bag and go. Well, you may have to let him go. You may have to help him pack his bag and say, okay, be on your way. If you're determined to destroy yourself, at least you're not going to be destroying me and the family, and you're not going to have all this unrest night after night or weekend after weekend. It'll be better if you leave. Okay, goodbye, Joe. And to help him pack. If you want to destroy yourself out there, that's your business. But you're not going to destroy us in the process. He may tell a wife, you know, you can't get along without me. The one that really hurts is if the children are involved and they're in college. He says, who's been paying your tuition bill? Hey, that's kind of tough to fight, isn't it? You mean that you're going to withhold my tuition? You're not going to make my car payments or whatever? And Joe says, absolutely not. Okay, the children have to be prepared for that, and that may happen. He may say to the wife, hey, if that's the way you feel about it, okay, my secretary would be happy to have me come in anyway. Okay, Mary has to be ready to accept that. He may turn to the older daughter, Mary, who is married, or Susie, who is married and living old, says, Susie, I'll just come move in with you tonight. And Susie says, no, you can't, Dad. It's been a prearranged. No, you can't live with any one of us. None of us are going to take you in. And hopefully we've got his parents hold on the fact, no, don't you take him in. Don't be an enabler again. He has to feel the full responsibility. You have to withdraw all the supports. And all of a sudden, Joe's out there like a newborn baby. Got no place to go. Nobody wants him. You see, interventions don't take just 15 minutes. I can recall an intervention I started about 8:30 on a Saturday morning. We didn't get the guy in the treatment until 4:30 that afternoon. And you sometimes say, well, what kind of people do you use in the intervention process? At what age can you begin? And the Johnson Institute for Minneapolis, who kind of developed this program, says anytime a child is 5 years of age, they can be involved in the intervention. Well, in this particular intervention, the little gal was 9 years of age. And she had been sitting there with her mother all day, just hanging on for dear life and crying every little while. And about 3:30 or so in the afternoon, the father, he was just frustrated. He just couldn't shoot down any arguments anymore. He had no place to go because the family was really agreed that you got to get into treatment, Pop. And in desperation, he yelled at his little nine-year-old, said, oh, why don't you quit your sniveling? I'm tired of it. He says, I'm scared. So what are you scared about? He said, I'm afraid you're going to kick me again. He said, I've never kicked you in my life. And by that time, the wife pulled up the girl's dress, and he had literally kicked her under the bed just the night or the day before. Another, you'd be amazed what these little kids will do. Another intervention I was involved with, this one didn't take as long because we started about 12:30 on a Sunday noon, and by 4 o'clock we had him in treatment. But the thing that broke him was his little 10-year-old twin daughter. The twin was the brother, and they had a birthday party just the day before. And to show how sometimes these things work at an opportune time, you know, crises help. They'd had a birthday party, and from the living room there was kind of a spiral staircase went upstairs, and he'd been up there drinking. And in the middle of this birthday party, he stands up at the top of the stair and relieves himself. After all, his bladder was filled, and he had to relieve himself. And this poor gal was just mortified that her father would pee down the stairway with all these friends around there. And when she told him that, he was so embarrassed. He said, did I really do that? Let's go to the hospital. So you never know what's going to be the thing that's going to kick the way. Another intervention, the pastor was involved in this particular intervention with one of the elders of his congregation, and the elder insisted that he didn't drink very much, and the pastor reminded him that you walked out yesterday with a gallon of communion wine. Oh, my goodness, how could that have happened? See? Well, you never know what's going to be there, but you need to be convinced of or united on what the alternative is going to be. Well, you know, we in our Lutheran church don't like to talk about divorce, do we? We say that's a no-no. Well, I've already retired, so I don't have to worry about being put on CRMR anymore. But there are times when I've suggested that you may have to let the guy go, and you may have to go through the shock of a divorce procedure to shock him into the reality of his illness. But you use divorce in an entirely different motivation. You don't go and ask for a divorce when you're full of anger and vindictiveness. You go when you really love the guy, and you're convinced the only way I'm going to finally push this guy over the edge to get into treatment is by threatening him with divorce. And you may even have to go get the file the papers. But you, I don't know what the laws are in Wisconsin or in Missouri, but I know in Wisconsin you can have them withdrawn at any time, up to the last moment. Whatever it takes to present an alternative which is going to get this guy into treatment. Because you see, gentlemen, without treatment, this disease is going to progress. And all the things you dread that might happen, I can guarantee you will happen if you don't get this guy into treatment. Because as sure as God made little green apples, the alcoholic only has one of two choices. He's either going to end up in some psychiatric hospital as a psychotic with his burned out brain, or he's going to be dead. He'll either have committed suicide or the alcoholism will have destroyed it, because alcoholism is a destructive, fatal disease. So we need to do something to prevent that. See? Now, let's say we finally get the guy into treatment. He's just mad in a wet hen. And people ask me all the time, what does it do to get him into treatment when he's so mad at everybody? Well, there's two very important things that happen, gentlemen. Number one, you get the booze out of his system, because we don't offer any booze in the hospital. His brain finally gets cleared out, and he can finally begin to do some good, clear, rational thinking. He can make some good, logical decisions. He can begin to recall, because blackouts is one of the very common symptoms of the alcoholic. He just doesn't remember. So we finally get him dried out, and he may even begin to recognize where he is and why he's there. The other thing that happens, he's there with anywhere from 80 to 100 patients, depending on how many we have in the house at a given time. And almost all of the, with one exception, all of our counselors are recovering people. The nurses are recovering. The staff, the doctors are recovering. Three of the chaplain, or two of the three of us are recovering. And he discovers that he's not alone in this business. My God, I didn't know there were so many men and women who had the same problem I had. I thought I was the only guy out there that ever beat his wife. I thought I was the only guy out there that ever had a DWI. I thought I was the only guy out there that ever reneged on his life insurance or whatever. And my goodness, you mean you guys have all done the same thing? And he's there from people who've been in Skid Row, and he's been there with people who are up the million-dollar echelon income per year. And he discovers that, hey, in alcoholism, it's a common denominator. The behavior is so much alike. So he's eating and sleeping and talking alcoholism all day. And we put him in a group therapy, and there's some people been in that group, have been there a few days, some have been there a month, and it's amazing how they begin to confront each other. Joe is in there about the second or third day. First day or two, we just kind of let him slide by. But by the third or fourth day, we begin to pick at him a little bit. Oh, Joe, what brought you in here? Well, he says, my wife thought I was drinking too much. I guess I got blasted a little too hard at our birthday party. Here I am. It's really no problem. And you can bet there's one of the other guys who's been here two or three weeks is going to zing right in him. He says, that's a bunch of crock. And they don't all use King's English out there. They say it very descriptively, and Joe knows what they're talking about. And he's right there on his defensiveness. And about that time, two or three other guys said, oh, Joe, just sit down for a while. Why don't you just shut up and listen for a while? You begin to understand that we practice honesty around here. And that bullshit you're giving us isn't doing you any good, nor us. So just sit and listen for a while. And a few days later, they zing on him again. And say, well, Joe, how are you doing today? Food tasting better? You begin to remember where you've been, what you've been doing? Yeah. And all of a sudden, Joe becomes one of the team. And he begins to recognize, yeah, what I've been doing has been very self-destructive, been destructive to my wife, to my children, to my job, to the police officer. And he becomes a very meek and mild individual because he finally gets in touch with the reality of his illness. But he also understands there's treatment available to him and how much better he begins to feel. And more often than not, before the end of his treatment, he and his wife are going to be together because we have a weekend session, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, where the husbands and wives are together, and he and his wife are off on a side someplace, and he's giving her a great big hug, and he says, hey, thanks, hon. I wish you'd have done this 5 years ago. I could have saved both of us a lot of misery. You see, fellas, you're going to have chemical dependent come into your parish. I can guarantee you. I'll bet 80% of your counseling problems are going to be related to chemicals. Now, I'm not saying every one of you has to be able to do an intervention, but you ought to know where the resource people in your community are who can help you do the intervention. Where's the nearest AA group? Where's the Al-Anon group? Where's the Family Anonymous group? They can be your greatest asset in the community. Every county mental health association has someone on the staff who should be trained to do an intervention. Get in touch with them. Find out who they are, what their telephone numbers are. Have them come into your parish and do a session sometime. Anyone in the parish wants to come in, they can hear what an intervention is all about. Because you're going to have people in the congregation who are timid, who are afraid of being identified. So you do it as a congregational thing so nobody has to begin to feel, hey, I'm one of you. See? It was interesting just yesterday as I was here, four of you came forward and identified yourselves as recovering alcoholics. Each one of you did it individually. I don't suppose that very many of you would want to stand up here this morning, hey, Ed, I'm recovering. I'm a member of the fellowship. Because somehow we want to protect our anonymity, and that's okay. But you see, once you've been through the program, you begin to understand how many of them there are. And as you start going to meetings here in the area of St. Louis, you begin to recognize, hey, you may see a brother of yours. Hey, there's another seminarian. I didn't know he had a drinking problem. There's one of the profs. Well, what do you know? I didn't know he had a drinking problem. Because you know one of the profs not too many years ago from here went into treatment. And he's doing a fantastic job. And he's allowed me to use his name. And that is no longer an anonymity problem. It was Dwayne Mayo. You ought to read his book sometime, No More for the Road. It's fantastic. Use the process, gentlemen. It's the most effective tool we have today of bringing people into treatment. I like the motto of the National Council on Alcoholism, which says the alcoholic is a sick person and he's worth treating. We got about 10 minutes. I wanted to get through this to give you people an opportunity for some response, some questions, some disagreements. Anybody at all? Anybody have something on their heart they'd like to get off at this? Yeah, fire away. Unfortunately, you know, we live in a fiscal community, and hospitals can only operate when they're making money or being paid so they can pay their staff. There are two exceptions, however. Let's say you come in to treat me, you don't have dime one for insurance, okay? And I can't speak for other hospitals. I can speak for our hospital up there. The first thing they'd ask you, of course, do you have insurance? No, I don't have any. Well, we have two options for you. We can either put you on the welfare roster, which unfortunately now has about a three-month waiting list. But we get you on the list, see? Well, it's unfortunate for the alcoholic because you got to treat the alcoholic when the iron's hot. You know, I got you convinced today to come into treatment. 3 months from now, you may change your mind. You may not be around anymore. The other option is there's federal funds known as Hill-Burton funds. Let's say I'm the doctor on call when you come in. And you are obviously sick. Your blood pressure is about to blow your head off. The wife has been there and describing what your alcoholism is, and I, as a doctor, have the option to say you are an emergency situation. I can put you ahead of all the people on the waiting list, and you can be admitted immediately. And your hospitalization will be paid by the federal Hill-Burton funds. Or you can go down. I can send you to City Hospital where they have to take you at any time. See? But you may not have the privilege of coming in to the Cadillac at DePaul Hospital. Yeah, it's an unfortunate thing, but money is a factor, fellas. It paid my salary, see? Go ahead.
Paying the bills. Some insurance companies will pay the monthly bills as the person's under treatment, but others won't. And particularly in the case where it takes the wife saying, get out of the house, what do you do in that case if she doesn't have a means of self-support?
This may happen. And she may have to go to work. Maybe the children are going to have to help support mom. Maybe her parents are going to have to help support mom. This may happen. That's right. It's one of the things you deal with when you set up the alternatives. What are you able or willing to do if the alternative turns out to be that he's going to say, go fly your kite, I'm leaving. And that might happen. Well, which do you want? Do you want to continue to live in that kind of an emotional, physical misery? Or do you want to gamble on, hey, I'm going to take care of my own physical and emotional, maybe even financial welfare. I'll go find a job, and there's all kinds of jobs up there in Milwaukee, at least at $3.85 an hour. You may be making sandwiches at McDonald's, but it's a job.
Do most of the coverages cover monthly bills?
Well, in Wisconsin, we are very fortunate. There's a state law in Wisconsin that all group insurance policies must include chemical dependence. There's a number of states, as some of you may be from Minnesota. Minnesota has that law. I know we do in Wisconsin. I don't know what the law is here in Missouri. But up there, all insurance programs must include chemical dependence by law. Now, they don't all pay 100%. A good many of them pay 85% up to the first 1,000 and then full coverage after X number of 1,000. It's very expensive to come into treatment centers. I'm not going to kid you. Yeah, the question back here.
Yes, sir. You mentioned at the beginning that you were seeking for us to know to raise the body.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you mentioned that towards the end of your talk that when an alcoholic mentioned, gee, honey, why didn't you do that 5 or 15 years ago?
Yeah.
I guess the question I'm asking is, do we have a number of, quote, functional alcoholics where they are able to have very little trouble with the law, they don't miss any work, the relationship in the home is strained, of course, because of the drinking, but what I'm asking is should we be sensitive that a man doesn't have to have all the classics of alcoholism to get to be an alcoholic?
Oh, definitely. I see Charlie sitting over here. I'm sure Charlie would have a chart of the Jelinek chart, the V chart, which is probably the thing which is most frequently referred to, or the 33 symptoms of chemical dependence. There's the early phase, the middle phase, the late stages phase, and you may be in the first phase, but you're just as alcoholic. You know, in the alcoholic circles, we frequently use the analogy, you've never been a little bit, well, you obviously not, you've never been a little bit pregnant, have you? You either are or you aren't. See? It shows a little more at 8 months than it does the first. Same with alcoholism. You may be in the first phase. It doesn't show too much. You don't have all the destructive symptoms already. But if you've lost control, you're chemically dependent. You're the alcoholic, although you may be in the first phase. But without treatment, friend, you're going to progress on ultimately to the late phase and death without treatment. I'm convinced of that. Yes, sir.
How much do you involve a person's faith in the treatment? And what about the people? Is it the treatment that you just gave there? And it sounds like it's geared toward more of a middle class. And I would think that a lot of people who would be dealing with it would not have those same morals and values in a lower class. A whole different system or philosophy of life, and also how much do we, as moderators, get involved in that? We could easily start giving up ourselves
until there's nothing left, helping
the family and running around and doing all the things in order to maintain
the
sanity ourselves.
Okay, I'm not sure I'll remember all. Stick your finger up one more if I don't get it all up. But you mentioned something about faith. I don't get into that at all in the intervention. Because by the time the individual has progressed with his illness to the point where the wife has come to you and said, hey, I need help, the faith relationship for all practical purposes is dead. The dependency has already been transferred from God to the alcohol by that time. He may be going through some of the niceties. He may go to church on Sunday, he may go to the sacrament, he may go to voters' meetings, etc. But it's just a mechanical thing. Because I'm convinced that you can't have a strong, active faith relationship to God and also be chemically dependent, actively chemically dependent. You know, once you've done something, once you've made the commitment to sobriety, that whole faith relationship reverses. And that's one of the things that happens in the serenity process. You transfer the dependence from the alcohol back to God. But it doesn't happen in the intervention. Because first something's got to happen up here. See? And I think sometimes we put the cart before the horse. In fact, the Lord, I think, was an excellent, example of that. He would feed the body, he'd get the body well, and then he'd talk to them about the relationship to him. And I think the same is true of the chemical dependent. As long as my thinking is still all screwed up, I'm not in a position to make any commitments toward God that are going to be of any lasting value. So my thinking's got to get straightened out first, and I have to begin to have a sense of a relationship to people and to myself, and then to God, not the other way around. That was your first question. What was the second one? You said something about different lifestyles. I disagree with you there. An alcoholic is an alcoholic. I don't care what level of strata of society or culture you come from. You see, alcoholism is blind. Alcohol is blind. It can't say, well, wait a minute, this is a fine Lutheran seminarian. I'm not going to mess him up. But this is a Catholic seminary, boy, I'm going to get him. Or this is a Unitarian, man, I'm really going to blast this guy right out of his chair. See? Alcohol has the same kind of effect on every individual. It is a depressant. It anesthetizes the central nervous system. See? Regardless of who you are or where you are in the cultural stratas. And the intervention is done the same whether I'm working with a doctor, a clergyman, or some guy that's just been pushing a broom down on State Street. And we use the same process regardless of where you are in economic or educational strata. In fact, in Wisconsin, we have a very strong, what we call the IPP program, Impaired Professional Program, which they use on physicians, attorneys, clergy, something like that. And Wisconsin's gone to the point where a chemically dependent medical person, a nurse or a physician, is on probation for 2 years in order to get their license back. See? But they use the same process of intervention with these guys as we do for some fellow who may have been a bricklayer someplace. Okay. And then what was your last one, I think? Oh, okay. Yeah, I think sometimes I've been in some clergy groups where they were concerned, well, gee, what's my relationship going to be to Joel if I'm the one that did the intervening with him? It's going to be stronger than ever because he knows he can trust me. Because I'm right there with him through the whole process of the treatment. Let's say Brother Berorth is his pastor. He's going to come see him at the hospital on a regular basis like he would if Joel had a broken leg or had an appendectomy. We get the whole family involved in the treatment process within the first week. We have a good family program lined up for them after post-discharge. We have a 14-week aftercare program for the alcoholic once he's out of the inpatient treatment, and we stay involved with him all the way through that thing. I'm the chaplain at the hospital. I see this guy almost every day someplace in the hospital. I remember this one guy who we did the intervention, where the pastor was there, and he said, hey, you know, you took a jug of communion wine yesterday. This guy hated me. Oh, he hated me. And he told me at the hospital, boy, he says, I don't care for you at all. I said, that's all right. That's all right. He happened to be the Lutheran Missouri Synod, you know. And I said, by the way, we have services on Sunday. Why don't you come join us? Well, he walked on, didn't say anything, but lo and behold, he was there. On Monday night, lo and behold, he was at my Bible study program. Before he left the hospital, he did his fifth step with me and gave me a great big hug. He said, thanks for being there. This is the kind of thing that works over and over. Because, again, a great thing had changed in his mind. He could begin to understand what he'd been doing. And the dependency had turned back to where it should be. You know, the A program says, God is your understanding, or a higher power. Well, to him, the higher power became the triune God again. Anyone else? Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
I had two questions. The first one related to the idea of reaching the bottom.
Yeah.
And from the reverse side, I was wondering that it could also be possible to lower the top. And I was wondering if church discipline might play a part in that, and possibly also the church's prayer. If there's any means of involving the church discipline concept into raising the bottom, and also perhaps lowering the top, so it doesn't seem so unfeasible.
Yeah. I don't know. Nobody's ever presented that. I've never even thought about it. I don't know. How would you use church discipline to get him into treatment?
Well, the idea of being cut off from the congregation.
Yeah. But I think it takes more than that. You know, you may cut him off from the congregation. You can't go to the sacrament anymore. But what are you doing about all the things he's doing at home or on the job or out on the street?
Lowering the top of getting the people involved.
Yeah.
These are all people who care.
Yeah.
What happens when the issue does come to the point of divorce, and assuming that the person finally gets to the point of reversal?
Yeah.
What steps then do you take?
Oh, okay. I've had the good fortune 7 times now in working through an intervention. The wife and the husband divorced, and I remarried them. See? Because they'd both been in treatment now, and they discovered they still love each other. One couple had been separated 3 years. Their daughter was 18, and the daughter was the attendant at the wedding, and she was also involved in the intervention prior to that. Which, again, I think just helps to emphasize how important it is that not only Joel gets treatment, but that Mary gets treatment too. And we strongly encourage Mary to stay involved in Al-Anon, as we strongly encourage him to stay involved in AA even after treatment. It's an ongoing process. They're convalescing, in a sense, the rest of their life. We often use the analogy of the diabetic. You know, you wouldn't tell the diabetic quit taking diabetes in, or quit taking your insulin shots in 89. It's a pain. Okay, I'll take them again in 90. He may be dead by that time. I feel just as strongly that the alcoholic needs to stay involved in his support system, which is AA, or she needs to stay involved in her support system, which is Al-Anon. I see he's standing. It's past 11:30. I will be around this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm hiding over here in the conference room of the library. Feel free to stop by and see me. I'll be around tomorrow with all day with the exception of a luncheon that I have with the faculty. until I would say around 4:30 tomorrow afternoon. And pray snow.
If you want to guarantee a time with Pastor Eggert, there is a sign-up list on the library conference room door so that you can claim a certain segment of his time. Otherwise, you can drop by on the chance that you'll find him, and the chance would be pretty good that you would.
Or I can stay here for a while, because what time is lunch here? 12?
Yeah, now? It starts to be served now. But, please do feel free, if you have the time and have an urgent question right now, to stay behind. But meanwhile, I think the rapt attention that was paid here and the many hands that have gone up for questions certainly bespeaks the fact that Chaplain Eggert has been speaking to something that we all recognize as a universal need, and one with which we're all going to be ongoing in our quest for knowledge and skills with which to meet it. Let's say a good thank you to Pastor Eggert.